Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening and welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here tonight with my co-host, Red Beckman, who will be joining us shortly. And we're looking forward to our show tonight. This is an exciting one for me. I've really been looking forward to this week and anxious to get our guest started tonight. Our guest tonight is Gus Breton, who I'll be introducing shortly. And I'd like to open us with a prayer. That's our tradition here at Walls in Our Minds, and I believe on a show like this, we'd better start it out right. Almighty Father, we just want to come to you, acknowledging you as the only self-existent one in this universe. And we acknowledge you as the creator that you did through the hands of your Son, and we're thankful that we can come to you and be able to rely upon you for your promises. And we trust in your Spirit, and we ask you to fill this show tonight with your Spirit. Open the minds of our listeners. Be with Gus tonight, launching out into this educational process of natural law, of common law, of your law. We recognize that you are the origin of this common law that we're talking about tonight. And we pray that what we say and do tonight will glorify you. And we pray that you'll take control. So watch out for all of those cracks in our door tonight for us, Father. We're thankful for your Son and the gift and the price that he's paid for us. It's in his name, Yahshua HaMashiach, that we pray. Amen. Well, I am really, really pleased to welcome Gus Breton back here to Walls in Our Minds. Gus has been on with us a number of times. He's certainly a close working friend of ours, and I'm just excited, Gus, to have you here tonight. How about giving our listeners a little bit of background on yourself and warm us up?
All right. Well, it's really great to be here again, and it is always nice to work with you, Terry. My background, I was born in Canada, came to the United States when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and was just a regular guy. I got involved in construction when I got out of high school, and still in construction, hanging drywall, and my interest in human nature has always been there, why people do what they do and don't do things, you know, makes you wonder sometimes. But in 2004, my interest in law perked up. My divorce started in 2002, and it was finalized in 2004, and I realized I didn't have a clue what happened to me. I wanted to know more. I wanted to understand the legal process, the legal society, and that's how my journey began. And then in, let's say, 2010 or 11, I was studying constitutional law and came across the concepts of redress, and I studied the redress provisions of both the federal and the New Hampshire Constitution. We have a mandate to our legislature here in New Hampshire that says that they have to hear petitions for redress. And so I put a petition in for redress of grievances. It was heard in 2012 by the New Hampshire legislature, and I spent the next couple of years up until maybe 7 or 8 months ago, I was promoting redress through my website, nhredress.org, and it didn't seem that people had an interest as much as they should in what's going on in their government and how to fix it. And I think people just got worn out trying and not getting any results. But redress, I thought, was definitely the way to go. And until I met Carl Lentz and started listening, well, I started listening to him in December. I didn't meet him until April. But once I started listening to what he was teaching, the law that's common to all men, regardless of which part of the world they come from, the difference between right and wrong, that's when I realized that things were a whole lot simpler than I had ever imagined. And I met Carl in April by chance. Somebody told me he was in New Brunswick and was looking for a ride to Boston, and I live in the Boston area, close enough. It's only 45 minutes away. So I volunteered, went up and picked up Carl, brought him to Boston. We had a great conversation. I spent the next 2 weeks with him and hung out and got to know who this guy was. And it was really eye-opening, because the stuff that he teaches is the roots of law, the real, real fundamental basics of right and wrong and how law really operates, not the stuff that the legal society would have you believe. And so it's a very different way of looking at things. And so I've been studying I really started studying after I met him and realized, you know, he was for real and wasn't just some fly-by-night guru. And spent a good portion of the month of May with Carl down in Virginia, working on cars and just hanging out. So I'm back in New Hampshire now, and I'm helping people learn this stuff as I learn it myself. And I started a website, and that one is redressfordummies.org. And it's a website where people can go to and learn the basics of common law and get started. I created a page about 3 days ago called About Common Law. And last night, I also do a talk show called Word Nerds. It's on Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. The call ID is 134084. And last night, with the group, we went through that page, and I realized how much stuff I missed. That's the advantage of working with so many people that are studying the same thing. So that's pretty much the background. Not sure how much more there is to say. The future looks good.
Well, I'll add a little bit to that, because I've seldom seen somebody dive in to a topic and commit themselves to it the way you have, and especially how quickly you've caught onto this learning curve. I've certainly come to trust, what you've learned and how you talk about it. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we're ready to do this show tonight. I have full confidence that you'll tackle these questions with great knowledge. And it's certainly been a good thing, I know, a good experience for you studying this, and especially becoming acquainted with and friends with Carl Lentz and his work, and I know that's really helped jumpstart you. But you've been studying this topic longer than just this year. I mean, you had a little bit of a jump on it, because when you came across Lentz and his work and stuff, you were already embracing that. And I just want to commend you for the research that you've done and how much of that you've shared with me and others. And I know that the people that have been associated with you for the last year have really come to trust you, and that speaks very, very highly for you. So I wanted to contribute that to it. Start us out by telling us a little bit about what common law is and how it differs from other kinds of law.
All right. Actually, you're right. My first exposure to common law, I'm thinking back, and I just found out today George Gordon passed away. He was a great man. And in 2002, somebody had given me some of George Gordon's material, a course on common law. And that's actually where I first began studying. I had forgotten about that, but that's where I first started out. And the common law that George Gordon was talking about was what's considered federal common law. It's the body of federal case law created by the federal court opinions. It's also widely regarded to be admiralty law. But the common law that I speak of is the law that is common to a man. And regardless of where that man is, he's taught right from wrong. And you don't take the cookies from the cookie jar. You don't kick your sister. Don't do this to the dog. You know, these are the kinds of lessons, the common sense lessons that people teach their children as they grow up. The common law that the legal society would have you believe is common law is the case law that is derived from the statutes that are written by the legislatures of the 50 several states. But as we move further through this topic, I'm going to talk a lot more about what common law was in our country before it was the United States of America, what the colonists did. The English common law is another type of law. It's another body of law, and that comes from the old English laws, the customs, the court decisions. They had specific names like replevins and trovers, and those actions, those causes of action, had very specific ways of moving through the court. And a lot of that was shed by the colonists when they came here. It became much less restrictive. And there's a book called English Common Law in the Early American Colonies, and it's a thesis from 1899 by Paul Samuel Rich, and he described how the colonists came over. And actually, I want to pull it up. He described it. You can find this, by the way, on Google Books. It's also on the website. Redress for Dummies. He says on page 11, the ideas of the Massachusetts colonists on the matter of law appear very clearly from a resolve of the General Court of the year 1636. The government is there entreated to make a draft of laws agreeable to the word of God, to be the fundamental laws of the Commonwealth. This draft is to be presented to the next General Court. In the meantime, the magistrates are to proceed in the courts to determine all causes according to the laws then established, and where there is no law, then as near to the law of God as they can. So when the people came here from England, they were looking for a lot more freedom, a lot more of the laws that were in line with the Bible, with the scriptures, and not so much in line with what the kings and the noblemen and the lords had created over the centuries. And he goes on to mention in his book on page 25, in Connecticut and New Haven, we find a similar a development similar to that of Massachusetts. The Connecticut Code of 1642 was copied from that of Massachusetts. The fundamental order of New Haven provides for the popular election of the magistrates, and for the punishment of criminals, according to the mind of God revealed in his word. The general court is also to proceed according to the scriptures, the rules of all righteous laws and sentences. In the fundamental agreement, all freemen assent the scriptures hold forth a perfect rule for the direction and government of all men in all duties. The scriptural laws of inheritance, dividing allotments, and all things of like nature are adopted, thus clearly founding the entire system of civil and criminal law on the word of God. So this was the case until this country, this federation of states, was created. And well over 100 years, 150 years pretty much, they were running with the word of God, and that was the law of the land. So when the Constitution was created, it was really to fill the gap that was missing for commercial law. The commerce is done in a much more rigid fashion. a lot more in line with the Old Testament, an eye for an eye, because in commerce you can't afford to have too much forgiveness, whereas the laws of a man here in our country, we were based, Connecticut, Massachusetts, the colonies, were creating law in line with the New Testament, based on forgiveness and seek fairness and equity and so on. So these are the kinds of things that were, I don't want to ramble, so I'm not sure where to go from here, but you know, those are the kinds of things that were set up at the beginning and how they slowly transition to what we have today.
Well, let's get to what we've got today and how it differs from other kinds of law.
Okay. Today we've got what people are mostly familiar with is statutory law. And statutory law is what legislators put out. You know, you elect people, those people go into office, they create laws that they believe are going to help society, that, you know, to guide the social contract. And these laws, the laws that were created before the Constitution were created along the laws of God. These laws are created with a different intention, and it's really to regulate commerce. And we have an Article 38. Our Constitution in New Hampshire, the Bill of Rights, has 38 articles. I'm sorry, it has 39. It originally had 38. And the last word in Article 38 was the laws necessary for the good administration of government. And I'll give you a little bit more about that in a second, but the laws that exist in the statutes are for the good administration of government. The government was created to protect and preserve and secure man's property. All right, for let me back up a little bit. A man is created in the image of God, and all men, being created equal, are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, such as life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. These are all properties. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men with the consent of the governed to protect these rights, to secure these rights. And so that being the purpose of government, the laws that are created as necessary for the good administration of government. So you'll see on the website, Redress for Dummies, it's, right now it's number 3. I'm going to be updating this as I get more information. But the Article 38 is very clear that the people have a right to require of their lawgivers and magistrates an exact and constant adherence to the fundamental principles of the Constitution in the formation and execution of the laws necessary for the good administration of government, not for the good administration of man. These statutes are specifically commercial. They are the law of God rules a man, and the law of statutes rules commercial activity. So they might come after you if you do something wrong with a statute, but sometimes those statutes are just codified law. They take the laws that, for instance, murder. There might be a code that describes murder. That doesn't mean it's only for commerce. However, you know, the bulk of the, you know, fishing licenses and things like that, the bulk of statutes are exactly that. They're there for commerce.
Well, that's interesting. Some folks have asked the question, you know, what does it take? How much studying does a person have to do? How much language do they have to know before they can walk, come into a courtroom or handle themselves sufficiently using common law where they're going in there and doing it on their own?
Well, common law as a form of defense is much, much easier to figure out than using common law to place a claim before the court. So I'll cover it in two parts, common law as a defense and common law as an offense. And as a defense, if you're being accused of something, our Bill of Rights, the United States Bill of Rights, at Article 4 or the Fourth Amendment, depending on how you studied, describes that no man shall be held accountable for anything except on a, no warrant shall issue except on oath or affirmation. So somebody has to swear that you did them wrong under oath or affirmation before the government can get involved in anything pertaining to a man. And people don't realize that, and they don't know that the number one thing that they need to do is force the man accusing them to take the stand and accuse them. They go along with, you know, you're being charged with statutes, you're being charged by the state or the people of the state. There's, you know, different states have different headings on their paperwork, but it's, you're being charged by a piece of paper. It's a complaint. Nobody is making a claim that you've done wrong. And so as a man, you have the right to face your accuser. That's in Acts 25:16. And to answer for yourself, to ask for forgiveness, these are the kinds of things that our law is based on. And it was the laws that existed before this current Constitution. And so at Article 9 of our Bill of Rights, it's very clear that the enumerated rights are not to disparage others retained by the people. The people have the right to go back in history and carry forward all the rights they've ever had. So, you know, you have the right to face your accuser. So a common law defense is really a whole lot simpler. There's more to it than that, but essentially the plaintiff must appear, the man must take the stand, he must accuse me, point his finger at me, and say, you did me wrong. And if nobody comes forward to do that, then why am I here? Okay. If nobody comes forward to do that, then there is no oath or affirmation, and I didn't show up voluntarily, you arrested me. And that warrant has no foundation. So, you know, the defense is a whole, and there's more to it than that, and I'm studying more. The common law offense, on the other hand, if you're looking to, if somebody's causing you harm, for instance, you want to build a deck on your house, building inspector won't let you do it for some reason. You've got an antique toilet and it flushes too much water, and they're telling you you can't do the addition on the house unless you get rid of the toilet. But you know it's a really old one. It's got the tank up top, and you know you just want to keep it. There's certain things that the government has no business interfering with, and in that case, when a man acting as a building inspector or acting in any other capacity, that's what they're doing. They're acting. They're government persons. They're not. It's always a man that's doing the acting, and therefore it's a man that's causing you harm. And that man is responsible for the harm he causes you, regardless of the immunity he believes he has to do his job. If you look at the Nuremberg trials, you know the soldiers. Their defense was, I was just doing my job. I took orders. I did what I was told. Well, you harmed a man. So that's no excuse. Taking orders and harming a man is no excuse. So if the legislature says this is the statutes, the law still prevails. Cannot harm a man, regardless of what the legislature creates. And the legislature creates gray area. God says this is right, this is wrong. That's all there is to it. And the legislature seeks to control that really fine line and expand it and give themselves an avenue of control. So God says you can eat the fish, you shall have dominion over the earth. Well, they say you need to have a fishing license. You need, if you want to have a bunch of cows, you have to have a dairy license for the protection of the public. So it's not that I disagree with the laws. I think I follow the driving laws, the getting from point A to point B laws, or whatever you want to call them. And I think they're good laws. They keep everybody safe. I don't run red lights just because I believe I can. So, these things are created, and there's a really good price for those, and I believe that most of the time they're perfectly fine, but if they cause you harm, you have the right to bring a claim in a common law court against the man that's causing you that harm, whoever's initiating that that trespass. That is a much more complex process. You have to know how to move your own court. For instance, if Bob Smith wants to put a claim against a man that's causing a trespass, then Bob Smith would hold the Smith court at the Hillsborough County Superior Court. So it would he would be in his court. The court is the king and his retinue, and his followers, his ensemble. So the man acts in that same capacity. He holds his court, the Smith court, at the county court. And so the public court building, the courthouse, is currently occupied by bar members. And if you want to get in there and hold your court, you have all the right in the world to do so, because that building was built with public funds. The attorneys that go there every day, they pay fees to use those rooms. And when we go there and we pay a fee, we should be able to use those rooms also. So there's this whole process of, you know, the summons, and if the man doesn't show up that has caused you harm, you have the right to a final judgment. And you cannot get a final judgment unless due process was complete. Due process involves the man being there to face his accuser, which is Bob Smith. So Bob Smith has to force the man to come in, sometimes issue a warrant to get that man into court to face his accuser so he can get final judgment and total closure on that case and move forward. So there's a whole lot more to moving a case than there is in defending yourself. Now, one of the ways of defending yourself is, for instance, in a foreclosure, you have a bank coming after you saying, you've done this, you've done that. You might put a claim in against the bank to force them to bring forward the proper paperwork, because otherwise they're moving a, you know, a forged instrument. You know, if they don't have it, they don't have it. If they do, fine, no problem. In another instance, you might have a police officer pulls you over and says that you've done something wrong and you don't know how to get out of it, but basically nobody's been harmed. It's just an infraction or whatever it is. And the prosecutor is the one moving the case. The prosecutor, if you go speak to the prosecutor and say, look, nobody was done harm. I was doing 12 miles an hour over the speed limit on the highway or something like that. And if you really wanted to fight that, I don't know if this is a good example or not, but the prosecutor is moving a case where there is no injured party. There's no man claiming harm. So he's moving a case against a person. Now, if you're willing to be a person using that driver's license under that contract, then you're guilty. However, if you were a man that was in his property, moving his property from point A to point B, then they need to have a warrant with a sworn oath or affirmation that somebody was caused harm. So this is the difference. The real big difference is in whether they're processing against a man or a person. And a person, the difference between a man and a person is probably the biggest thing people need to understand. A person is someone with a mask. It's a man with an obligation or a duty to the social contract to perform in a very specific way depending on the title that they hold. For instance, a sheriff or a doctor, a magistrate, a senator, a county prosecutor, building inspector, town manager. These are all titles that people have. And when they are at work, they are a person. When they walk away, when they punch out, they are no longer that person. They are now Bob or Frank or Jimmy. And some of the less obvious titles that carry these obligations are a teacher or employee or mother or father, student, participant, taxpayer, defendant, driver, citizen, fisherman, child. These are all statutory terms that fall under the jurisdiction of the courts. So when you're talking about your child in court, you don't talk about your kid, you don't talk about your children, you talk about your property or you talk about your issue. So there's other words in common law that you would use that cause you to remain in common law at all times as a man rather than stepping into their jurisdiction as a person where they now assume control of your life. So these are there's some complex stuff, but once you learn it, it's really not that bad.
Gus, you know, most people today don't have a clue about common law, and it's just like one of our chatters said, you know, it's kind of like you start talking about common law and you kind of get the deer in the headlights effect, right? But they also believe, you know, most people believe that, you know, you can't bring common law into court. They think there has to be a common law court before you can bring common law to the court. You know, maybe you want to talk a little bit about a court of record. Maybe you want a little, give them a little bit of an example that this is not just theory, that this is, you know, it's actually working out there, that people have had their children restored to them where they've been attacked by Child Protective Services, and it's been used in different venues and different places in the United States and Canada and Britain. Can you kind of talk a little bit about that and you know, bring this down to a level where the guy's saying, okay, why should I listen to this? I'm going to go into court next week, and I've got an attorney that's working with me, and why should I not go in there with that attorney and tell me why this is anything more than just theory?
Why is it more than just theory? Well, first of all, I'll explain what a court of record is. A court of record is a court of record generally has a seal, but doesn't have to have one. However, it does have to have the power to imprison or to fine for contempt. And it also keeps a permanent record of the proceedings. So if you're in court and you ask the judge, you know, is this a court of record? Usually the answer I get is, of course, look, we're recording over here. Well, that's not what it means. A court of record keeps a permanent record forever, that it doesn't go away after 10 years. They don't destroy the records 20 years down the road. It's a permanent record. And the reason that is because if you've been done wrong, your children have a right to come back 20 years later. There is no statute of limitations in common law. If somebody's been done harm, then, you know, or injury, you know, they have a right to remedy, regardless of how much time goes by. It might take 20 years to find out who caused the problem. So, you know, or it might not be safe to bring that issue forward for 20 years. So just because, you know, something happened, that doesn't mean you can't get remedy, you know, years later. So that's what that's, you know, one of the big reasons for a permanent record. The other thing is the court of record proceeds according to the common law, not statutes or codes. One of the big things about that is when an attorney goes to court with you, the attorney has no firsthand knowledge. And I give this scenario sometimes, especially in divorce. You have a husband and a wife, they split up, and they each get their attorney because they have no idea what they're doing. They both go tell their story to their attorney, and they're swelling the story to, you know, to favor them, to make them look good. And the attorneys know this. They know these people are just, you know, they're making themselves look good. They didn't do anything wrong. And then they go to court. The attorneys stand before the judge and proffer. They offer proof. And the judge knows that these attorneys have been lied to. These attorneys have no first-hand knowledge. And that these attorneys are just there to tell a good story as best they can and to bring the case, you know, through to some end at some point in the future, but there's nobody there testifying. There's no firsthand knowledge, and that's statutory. In a statutory court, the evidence is weighed from one side to the next. Who's got the best story? Who put on the best performance? In a court of record, there is no proffering. There is no offers of proof. It's everything has to be based on testimony. Everything has to be based on verified. If you bring an affidavit to court, that affidavit doesn't mean anything. Somebody has to stand there on the stand, has to swear under oath that every element of the affidavit is true. They have to have firsthand knowledge of the entire thing. So affidavits are no good. Most paperwork, I can't think of any paperwork that would stand in a common law court. For instance, if you have two people that are claiming land, that's my land. No, that's my land. Well, if you've been on that land for 40 or 50 years and you got it from your granddad, then there's a whole lot of evidence that it's your land. And if somebody comes forward saying, well, no, you know, my great-great-grandfather said it's you know, it was mine, and here's the paper to prove it, that paper doesn't mean a whole lot. There's nobody who's going to verify that paper, whereas you can bring in 30 or 40 people that will testify, yeah, that's Bob's land. Bob's been there 40 years, and I remember his grandfather had that land before him. So you've got all this firsthand testimony, and in common law, that's what rules the day. Now, the other thing about the common law is it has a tribunal which is independent of the magistrate. The magistrate's job is to witness the truthfulness of the claim and the order that you put into the court. So you create your order, you present it to the magistrate, and then you move your claim through court, and he pays attention to what it is you wish for remedy, and if the truthfulness of the claim is presented, and if it is, he will witness it, pass it to the clerk, who is also in the courtroom as a second witness, because as we've been taught, on the testimony of two people, a thing shall be established. So on the testimony of the magistrate and on the clerk, the thing is established. Now, you can also have a trial by jury, and in that case, it's the jury and the clerk that are the two witnesses. So these are the differences that a court of record differs from a statutory court. Now, is it possible to hold your own court? Well, there's people that have been doing it. One good example, I've got a YouTube channel. It's under my name, Gus Breton, which is also, if you want to get a hold of me on Skype, that's also my Skype name, Gus Breton. Gus.Breton, sorry. And if you go to my YouTube channel, you'll see Mr. Daly, you'll hear Mr. Daly talking to Carl about birds of prey, that he's in an agreement with another man who has these birds, and I guess they go to airports and they get rid of the pigeon population around the airports, and then they go home, and this is a business that this man has. However, he's got no license. He doesn't have a license for the birds. They claim some of them are endangered species. So this is the name that the Canadian government is giving to this man for his property. He calls them property, and he has a right to call them property. He can call them whatever he wants. It's his property. But the Canadian government felt that they had the right to seize the birds, and that's exactly what they did. They showed up. They took all the birds. When it got to court, the man told the judge that he was willing to pay whatever fines were required of him. However, he required the immediate restoration of his property. And the hearing came to a screeching halt. The judge looked at the Crown attorneys and ordered the immediate return of this man's property. What followed next is these attorneys were all in the hallway screaming at each other to try to figure out who was going to be held accountable for the robbery. Because if the man's getting his property back and hasn't done anything wrong, then that means somebody's going to be held liable for the robbery of those birds. Now, this is a pending case that's going on in Canada right now. So the man was restored his property. In other cases, there's a very popular case is Jonathan and Jesse in New Brunswick, which is who Carl was visiting when I went up to pick him up. And they had lost their children because they refused to vaccinate. They refused to allow the kids to have the school lunch at the school they wanted to. They would give their children their own meals, paper bags to bring to school. And government in New Brunswick was concerned about the children, and so eventually the CPS showed up. And they found that there was an unregistered rifle in the house. There was some herb-bearing seeds, and actually seed-bearing herbs, and things of that nature. And so they took the kids, all four of them, and Jonathan and Jesse did not see their children for 5 months. And Carl was doing a talk show. His talk show is Uncommon Law by Carl, and I believe it's 127469 is his call number. I'll have to check that, but Uncommon Law by Carl. And he was doing his calls, and somebody was saying, hey, your stuff don't work. You can't do this kind of thing. The courts will never listen to it. And so he told everybody, I will help the first couple, the first legitimate couple that's, you know, that's good people, get their kids back. And Jonathan and Jesse happened to hear that. They called in and said, you know, hey, help us get our kids back. Carl said he wouldn't go back on the airwaves until those people got their kids back. And 10 days later, they had their kids. They hadn't seen them in 5 months. The next hearing that was scheduled was for adoption, and the kids were going to be gone forever. And in 10 days later, they got their kids. I went to Canada to pick up Carl. I met Jonathan and Jesse. It was the one-year anniversary of the return of their children. And so I got to meet their kids. I got to meet Jonathan and Jesse. And you know, this is a true story. This is what Carl's been doing. He traveled 5 weeks through England at the end of 2013, helping people there do things. He spent 5 weeks in Canada before I picked him up. He started in British Columbia and worked his way across Canada. I picked him up in New Brunswick. So is this stuff possible? Absolutely. There's people getting good results all over the place, you know, in every single area of law that you can imagine.
Well, let's back up to a little basics here. Let's tell us what the advantage of acting as a man is.
Well, acting as a man means that you are not bound to the statutes. If you are not a man, then you are something else. And, for instance, we cannot define, you're never going to find a definition for man. It doesn't exist. They'll say it's the male version of a human, things like that. They can't define man because these companies that create these dictionaries cannot define their creator any more than we can define our creator. And so a man made in the image of God has the highest standing there is. There's people who call themselves a sovereign man or a free man. These adjectives only diminish the man. The man is created the way he's created. That's all there is to it. So any title that you take, for instance, if you have a driver's license, you're assuming the role of a person if you're using that license. So you're a person known as a driver. And in other instances, you might be a person known as a fisherman or a person known as a fireman. So when you're in court, if they can attach that title to you, then they are able to hold you accountable to that contract somehow, whatever the contract is. So, you know, and if nothing else, they call it a social contract. So it's not easy to wiggle out of that. The man, however, who has no latches, he's got nothing attached to him by way of contract, can stand in court and say, I don't understand legalese, which is an actual language. It was termed in 1914. It's the language of legal documents, and that's what statutes are. So a man is not accountable to those statutes because there is no law that requires a man to understand the language of legal documents. So a man can stand in court and say, I don't understand the language of legal documents. I don't understand the customs of the legal society. Customs of our society, of, you know, the customs of Salem, Massachusetts at one time was to burn witches. That was their common law. So the customs of the legal society and the language of the legal society is absolutely foreign to a man. However, if you're a person then you're completely stuck. You're in the web. So to be a man in court frees you from that. And one good word to describe that is idiot. If you're an idiot in the legal society, that means you're a common man. You're a private person. You're somebody who's not trained in that specialty, that special area. For instance, you have doctors that are part of the medical society, and you have dentists that are part of the dental society. So they all have their own languages and their own specific words. Well, they're not actually words. They're called terms. Webster's 1828 dictionary, for instance, is a dictionary of words, whereas Black's Law is a dictionary of terms. And if you're a man, you don't use terms. You use words. However, we've been taught through school to use a variety of words because we got our gold stars for using synonyms. And so we were never taught to be very exact and precise with our language. We've become very sloppy, which is a real hard habit to break. I find myself working with Mike and Mark, John, some of the guys on the calls, and we write things together. And they've been listening to Carl for, you know, a year, and they know all the words not to use. And I know not to use them, but I don't catch on as fast. So I'll say words, and they'll correct me, and we have a good time. But it's really, when the pressure's on, are you going to be able to remain a man in common law at all times? Or are you going to somehow get tripped up? One of the words that a judge may use to trip you up, to cause you to fall back into his jurisdiction, is the word you, Y-O-U. And a judge can simply say, would you like a glass of water before we begin? And if you answer that question, you have assumed the role of a person, because the word you is a joinder. It's you is plural, and it's accusative. So when the word you is used in a statutory court, even though you're trying to evoke common law, you can go back and forth with the judge, because that word you is binding you, the man, to you, the person. It's a plural. So you have to be careful of these words. There's quite a bit to learn. It's certainly not as easy as I might make out to sound. But you know, like I said, as a defense, the bottom line is someone has to appear. Somebody has to point a finger at you and say you did me wrong. They have to appear. The plaintiff has to appear. I think I'm rambling. Where was I going with that?
That's all right. I'll get you back on track here in just a second. I do want to mention tonight that we are simulcasting with Crusade Radio. And, Jim, just so you know, you do have a live mic, and you guys are welcome to jump in here. I do have a couple of people who have raised their hands to ask a question. I'm going to open up the floor maybe in about 10 or 15 minutes. So if you've got your hand up, we will get to you. We do see your hand up. I've got one in area code 661 and one in 817. I believe I know who both of those are, but we will get to you here shortly. So don't give up and don't go away. We do invite your questions here during the second hour of our show. Well, we talked, the question was, what's the advantage of acting as a man? You know, we've heard the words sovereign tossed around. We've heard people say, I'm a freeman, and they go into court and they proclaim that, I'm a sovereign. And we watch them get crucified. So maybe you might want to talk just a little bit more about what advantage is given, not just the fact that you don't have to know the legal ease and you can act as an idiot and that can actually be a good thing. But, what are the consequences of these people walking in there that don't really know the common law or haven't quite got to the point where they can utilize what they've learned in court? What's the consequences of walking in there and not really having your act together or proclaiming yourself to be a sovereign or something? What happens to those people and what's the consequences of it?
The word sovereign is to be the creator of something. So if you're in court saying that you're a sovereign, you're saying you're the creator of that court. You're, you know, it just doesn't work. The role that you are playing in that court is that of a defendant. And a defendant is a person with a very specific role, which is to be a piñata and to get the crap kicked out of them. That's it. That's the only role you play when you're in their court. So you can, you know, defend yourself, say you're an 88, you know, it depends on the case. But, you know, better than that is to bring a claim in against them for moving a case, you know, bearing false witness against you or moving a forged instrument through the court. When you move your case as a man, then it is your court, and you are able to set the rules of the court, the procedures of the court, when the hearings are going to be, when, you know, whether or not you're going to have things one way or another. You know, these are the kinds of things that you can do as a man in court, in your court. So the ultimate advantage is really that you can hold your court.
Well, you kind of got into it a while ago, but I think it'd be good to maybe have a little repetition here. How do you establish yourself as a man to the court?
You file a claim. You write up a claim, and a claim has to have certain ingredients. I started writing them down, and I realized there weren't as many as I thought. I thought there was a lot more, but basically there's a controversy, so there needs to be at least two people. There has to be a cause of action, you know, whether it's a forgery or, you know, some kind of trespass. Ultimately, everything comes down to two types of trespass. There's trespass, which is a harm, an injury, or a loss to a man, or there's trespass on the case, which is the case being moved in court. If somebody puts paperwork into your case that you do not allow, that's trespass on the case. So there has to be a controversy. There has to be a cause of action. There must be a specific claim of wrongdoing. You have to actually claim that something did cause you harm, that particular cause of action. There must be a specific remedy sought by the claimant, the man making the claim. You can say, I want $20 a day for harassment or whatever it is you seek, but it has to be logical. It has to make sense. You can't ask for $1 billion because somebody, you know, somebody stole your rabbit. So, you know, it has to make sense to a jury. And the other thing is the claim must be sworn or affirmed to be true. So when a simple claim, for instance, would be, I, a man, claim wrongdoer trespass by way of extortion, and I require compensation of 60 hours of community service. I say here and will verify in open court that all herein be true. Those three sentences make up an entire claim. They have all the ingredients of a claim. You don't need 40 pages of documents. And, you know, these people who go into court as a free man or a sovereign on the land, they go in and they say how this treaty says this and the Constitution says that and the Articles of Confederation and the Reconstruction Act of 1867, you know, all things that I got sucked into over the years, all these things don't mean anything. You're a man. Why are you trying to explain to your creation, the government, all these things that they really don't care? That, you know, you're a piñata. If you want to be successful, if you want to win, then you need to be moving the court. You can't be in their court allowing them to move you. So I don't know if I answered the question.
I think you got there. What's the importance of a written brief or filing your claim in writing? What's the importance of that?
Well, the claim, like I said, you know, I, a man, claim wrongdoer trespass by way of extortion, that's your claim. And in the heading, it says who the wrongdoer is. So you can name them, or you can just say wrongdoer. But what if you don't know who the wrongdoer is? It might be, you know, I, a man, claim John Doe trespass by way of extortion. That doesn't say who you are. It doesn't say who they are. You can still get a case number because you're willing to pay the fee and you want a hearing, and I'll introduce myself before the jury. Nobody needs to know who I am. I'm a private man. And so, I'll summons the wrongdoer as soon as I find out who it is, but I want to start building my case. I want to start putting things into my case, and when my case is ready, I will have it served upon the wrongdoer. So, getting started doesn't really involve a brief. It doesn't involve the kind of paperwork that people see attorneys put in. And there's no appeals either. There's no appeals in common law. When a jury makes a decision, that's it. You have 12 men in that jury, man, woman, that are acting in the capacity of the Almighty. And there's no one to appeal to. So everything in that court has to be verified. Only testimony can be taken. It doesn't matter how much paperwork you put in. None of that paperwork matters in common law. Everything has to be verified. So the brief is not going to be real big. You might have exhibits, for instance, when Jonathan and Jesse put their claim in against the Crown in New Brunswick. I got it right here. Hold on. Jesse's claim was that I, a woman, claim wrongdoers trespass upon property. I require immediate restoration of said property. I require compensation of $1 per second for each property held in naked possession. I will forgive the debt of those that trespassed against me, as I would wish those that I trespass upon to forgive my debt. That was her entire claim, and she attached exhibits A, B, C, and D, the pictures of her children, because she did not say, I want Jonathan and Bobby and Frankie returned to me. Those names are private. She didn't have to tell them who those kids were or what their names were or describe anything about them. She gave them a picture and said, I want that property, my property, returned to me. So if there's nobody here that has a superior claim to my property, I want it back. And the kids were spread out through the province, and she was told that, she was asked, the judge asked her, they said the Crown wishes to have 3 days to get the kids together and to get them back to you. And she agreed to that, and so that Friday she had her kids.
Is it necessary in that writing and in putting your claim in or your brief in that you give judicial notice that you are a man? Is there a requirement to invoke or evoke your rights to have your claim heard under common law? What about that?
Well, typically a judicial notice has to do with the law. You're reminding the judge, the law says this, the law says that. However, when you write up a common law claim, you're saying that the wrong is extortion. So extortion is putting pressure on somebody to do something they wouldn't otherwise do to get something. Somebody's trying to take something from you. That's the elements of extortion. So the judicial notice doesn't really need to be there because you're not going with the statutes. You're going as to whether something is right or wrong, which is going to be determined by the jury. So there is no judicial notice. The magistrate is only there as a witness. There's really very little paper that goes in. You might have, for instance, I have a friend who got pulled over in Georgia, and he had a bad taillight, plate light or something like that, and the officer wanted to search the car, and against his will, the officer did search the car, found a half ounce of pot, and the officer charged him with possession of an illegal substance and arrested him, took his car. The next day, he took his car out of impound and filed, over the next week or so, he filed charges against the cop for stealing his property, for robbery, because there's no man bringing forth a claim. And, the stuff is real simple. It's just robbery. Did somebody take my property? Well, it's an illegal substance. Really? I call it property, and it's mine. So, I can prove I paid for it. It's my stuff. So, this stuff really boils down to something real simple. It's either, and everything is property. There's no such thing as something that's not property. Everything is property, and it belongs to one man or another. For instance, the all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These things are all property. Everybody realizes that life is a property, and they realize that liberty or freedom is a property. However, the pursuit of happiness, well, happiness is something you hold and you own, and if somebody disturbs that, they're trespassing. They have no right to administer your happiness. And the pursuit itself, you have the right to pursue happiness. Who has the right? You do. So it's that right to pursue itself is a property. So there's really nothing that falls into a category outside of property. And property is defined as that which is proper and exclusive to your use. So, you know, that brings up like property tax. How can they tax something that's property? So that's always a good topic for debate. One I haven't figured out yet. But everything comes down to property.
Gus, what's the risk of going into to a court without filing that written brief or claim? If you don't put it in there in writing, what's the risk?
Well, the notices, to get back to the judicial notices, the briefs, you do put notices into the court, and the notices are what the rules of court are, the rules of procedure, whatever specifics that you wish your court to operate with. But the risk of not putting them in, if the rules of court are not clear, for instance, one of the rules in my court is legalese is grounds for contempt. I don't want to hear that stuff. Don't come in here talking to me about stuff that's in Black's Law Dictionary. I'm a man. I don't understand that stuff. Don't use it in my presence. It's disgusting to me. So if you don't have those rules laid out, then it's a free-for-all. And so, you know, that's one danger of not having everything laid out.
So if you go into court as a man and evoke common law, you don't have to follow the rules of procedure established by the Bar Association?
Well, that's a kind of a complex question. Evoking common law is something you do in defense. If somebody's coming after you for something, you can evoke common law and have the entire process moved into a common law court. However, when you begin a claim, you begin in common law if you begin it as a man. If you begin it as a fireman, then you're going to proceed according to the statutes. So it all depends on how you begin the process, but to invoke is to claim. If you're being accused by the United States of America of getting tapping into a water supply, or who knows, I don't know what they would accuse you of, but you can, as a man, say, let's say fishing, for instance. You were fishing in a Yellowstone National Park, and they come at you and they say, you can't fish here, you broke this law, this thing, this statute. You can evoke common law in your defense and say, I'm a man, I have a right to the Bill of Rights, where is your, you arrested me with a warrant, I want to see who signed, who issued that warrant and the oath or affirmation to back it up. So, that's evoking common law. On the other hand, when you do start a claim, you start it off in common law, so you're not evoking anything, you're just walking in it, you're in common law at all times.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. You've been summoned to court, and you evoke common law. How does that change the court? What's the difference?
Well, the difference is you evoke common law. I'm trying to think of somebody. All right, there's a man in Canada who filed tax returns with the IRS. Lives in Canada, but filed with the IRS. And the IRS turned over their paperwork to the Department of Justice. the Department of Justice extradited the man, and he's now in Seattle. And they were going, their case against the man was going all well and dandy until they had a Feretta hearing to determine whether he was competent to stand trial. And one of the questions was, what was your education level? He told them that he had a university education. So they determined that he was competent to stand trial. So his wife has been sending him information, and through email they communicate, and she's been sending him information on common law and how to evoke common law, the nature of the process and so on. So he's he already went through trial. He's already been found guilty. He's supposed to be going to sentencing, and he wrote a letter to the court letting them know that he had, I think he said he had ineffective counsel, because he was not competent to defend himself in common law. And as a man, he had the right to common law and to evoke it. And he also claimed that the man that was his standby counsel was not skilled in common law. So now they're having a hearing in a couple of weeks to determine what the heck they're going to do about this, because they processed this man as a person competent in legalese, and now he's claiming he was not competent. And I'm betting if he plays his cards right, he can force them to have a retrial.
You said what the consequences might be for him, but how does it change the court?
Well, they would have to... how does it change the court? Well, he is still in their court. He's still going to be a defendant, but they're going to have to play by a different set of rules, and that's a little bit outside of what I've been studying. I don't know, maybe we can revisit that sometime. His better defense would be to move a claim against the prosecutors for bearing false witness against him, because there is no plaintiff. There is no man claiming a wrong has been done. The United States government cannot show that they have suffered a loss, injury, or harm. So, the better defense for him would be to actually move a claim.
Let me rephrase the question. Who can bring a claim against a man?
Another man.
Is there another man in the court ordinarily?
Typically in a court setting, in a statutory court setting, which is what we're all used to, there is a complaint. An officer pulls you over, gives you a speeding ticket. He complains that you were doing 20 miles an hour over the speed limit. He's not making a claim against you. He's simply informing the government that you are doing something that the government believes you should not be doing, and he's complaining. And that's what happens in a, for instance, with this man and whatever the issue is that he was doing with the IRS. The United States government cannot make a claim. They are not a man. They can only complain of his behavior. And unless they can prove that there was an actual harm, injury, or loss, there's nothing that they can do.
So under common law, there is no claim against that man, because there's no man bringing that claim. It's just another legal fiction, if you will, that's bringing and there's been no injury to someone. That changes the court substantially, because it takes the man out of the jurisdiction of that court, unless there is another man bringing a claim of injury against him, correct?
That's correct, and it's a very common practice. Attorneys do it all the time, and when an attorney is doing this to a man, it's called barratry. It's ambulance chasing, and they have they actually have a very specific name for it. Let me see what it's called. SLAP. Strategic lawsuit against public participation. For instance, if you have Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Well, Mr. Smith is doing things that Washington doesn't want him to do. You know, Ron Paul, that kind of a guy. So they pursue him with lawsuits where there's actually no plaintiff. For instance, you know, the United States of America is not a plaintiff. It's not a man claiming harm. Well, it's a plaintiff, but it's not a claimant. And so they have actually something called slap laws to prevent strategic lawsuits against public figures for that very reason, because it's fictitious litigation. It's vexatious.
You know, we've heard comments that basically have been fomented, if you will, or put into play to propagandize people by the Bar Association, that a man who represents himself in court is the equivalent of a brain surgeon trying to do surgery on himself. can you tell us the difference between going pro se, because you know, everybody talks about, well, I'm going to represent myself, and they call him a pro se litigant. What's the difference between that and acting as a man?
Well, you're not acting as a man. You're acting as a pro se litigant. If you don't want to act as a pro se litigant, then you be a man. And this was brought up by one of the guys on the call last night. It's a very good point. That when you're a pro se litigant, you have a license for that case only to be involved in that case. You have a bar license only for that case. So as a pro se, somebody, when they call you pro se, that's a person within the legal society. That's not a man. So you can act as a pro se litigant. Okay, you're an actor, or you can be the man. You can take the mask off and be the man. And so the difference is everything we've talked about. You can move a claim, you can invoke common law. There's things you can do that you cannot do as a pro se litigant. If you're in a case pro se defending yourself and you evoke common law, you're stepping out of that shell and out of the mask, out of the costume. And they will put you back into that costume if you're not careful. So, you know, that's where the cool.
Hey, Terry, this is Jim Cook.
Jim.
I'd like to ask Gus some questions or try to bring some information into this conversation. Gus, when you're talking about injury, loss of harm, you're talking about corpus delicti. It's
correct.
It means that you have injury, loss, and harm, and there has to be a victim. Now, in my sister's case, she never appeared in court. On the summons, which is the contract or the offer to contract, we wrote a judicial notice, and we sent it in with it. It was all notarized. And we told the court that she didn't have a license. So we told the court pretty much that she was exercising her right to travel and that they searched her car illegally, which violated two federal laws. And we just sent the traffic ticket back in and told them that we did not want to enter into a contract with the court. Now, the district attorney sent her a letter saying, oh, well, why don't you come into the office and we'll resolve this matter? And she sent him another letter stating that I do not wish to contract with the court. I do not agree to those proceedings. And we wrote up another judicial notice that told him that she was a flesh and blood woman on the land, and basically that it's another Latin word that means that you're a flesh and blood a person on the land, and you've given up none of your rights. It's corpus diminutive maxima or something to that effect.
Yeah.
I may have pronounced that wrong. But we sent it back in, and she never heard from him ever again. This was in a court case in New York. And she went back down to Florida, and her driver's license taken away from her because she didn't pay a toll. So she went and she settled up with the people at the toll by sending a letter to them and doing the same thing. And she went back to the registry and got her license back, and it was never canceled after that point. Now, why? Here's the question after all that is, why would you even want to go into court if you don't have to? Let's say a driving infraction where traffic on the driving summons really means to be engaging in commerce. That's why they say if somebody was trafficking in drugs. So they're using these terms that have legalese meanings that don't mean what you and I believe them to mean. And driver is a person who's operating a commercial vehicle. And a traveler is a person who's exercising his right to travel by automobile. An automobile and motor vehicle are two different words. If you look up 18 U.S.C. 31, a motor vehicle is defined as an automobile used for commercial purposes, whereas an automobile is something you travel in just to exercise your right. So if they get you on that offense because you don't have a license, you haven't entered into a contract, and therefore you don't have to obey the code.
Jim?
Yes.
Jim, what's your question for Gus here?
Well, the question is, why go into court in the first place, especially if you don't belong there? Those type of things.
Okay, well, if you can avoid going to court, and you certainly can. The minute you get a ticket, you should go to the prosecutor and let the prosecutor know. You know, the next day, if possible, I'm bringing you back this ticket. I didn't want to get tased on the highway. I didn't want to, you know, be assaulted by the officer if he misunderstood what I was trying to communicate. So I just took the ticket, and I'm bringing it back to you to let you know that I was simply in my property going from point A to point B. Now, the right to travel, a lot of people use that. The right to travel is, if you look up the roots of that, it's the right to go from one state to another. Okay, there's no checkpoints between Massachusetts and New Hampshire and Maine and Vermont, Colorado, you know, Nevada, Utah, Montana. I mean, you can go from state to state wherever you happen to be. That's the right to travel. The right to move your property from point A to point B is a right that you've always had. You can get on your covered wagon and go wherever you want. You don't have to follow the highway. You can be off the highway. You can off-road. So the right to travel is definitely not the issue. But as far as staying out of court, if you can write a letter that says, you know, a real basic letter would be, I know that the government does not exist to cause harm to a man. In fact, I know that the government exists to secure my property, my rights. And at this time, this thing that's coming against me here is causing me harm, and I'd like to settle this out of court. Please provide me with the name of the injured party, and I'll settle everything. I'll settle all claims accordingly in private. So, you know, that's one way to just simply address the issue. And if you can address the issue with letter writing, what you explained here, okay, I had a very similar issue. I was going through Washington, D.C. The strobe lights went off. They sent me a ticket in the mail 2 weeks later, and I told them that they didn't have jurisdiction over me, and if they pursued the ticket, that they were agreeing that the court of proper jurisdiction was in Concord, New Hampshire, and they were also agreeing to my fee of $25,000 in advance for every court appearance that I made. Now, 8 months later, they sent me a postcard telling me that, you know, they didn't have enough evidence to pursue the complaint. And I thought that was funny. I had forgotten all about it. And so, you know, yeah, there's these other ways where you can claim the right to travel. There's all these other things you can do. But, you know, typically if you can stay out of court, that's certainly the best way to go.
Okay, now I have one follow-up question. Now, Some people say that when you go into court, when the judge brings you up to the front of the court or to talk to him, you're supposed to ask him what the true nature and cause of this offense is against you. Now, some people look at this and say, well, you know, the true nature and cause of the action against you is because of the bankruptcy in 1933 and the money is being siphoned off for the bankruptcy.
Okay. Why are you supposed to ask that question?
Okay, well, basically, they claim, this isn't the way I approach things, but the true nature and cause question. The courts were set up and all this law was set up after the bankruptcy of 1933. And the money
let me stop you right there. That's getting into anything like that is extremely complex. Well, what we're trying to do is teach something that every man knows in his heart is right and wrong. Now, that's the walk that's common to man. And if the issue is pushed, we're going to end up in front of a jury of a whole bunch of people that know what's right and wrong. And you're either going to be found guilty or not. And that's really what it comes down to. And knowing how to access the courts and force the issue. Where is the man that accuses me? Him on
right.
the stand,
well,
tell him to point his finger at me.
You didn't allow me to finish, because basically the true nature and cause of this action against me requires a man to come against. Now, to finish the thought, is when you go into court and the judge wants you to partake in his contract in the court, the money that's siphoned off from that goes back to the holders of the note when we went under bankruptcy and the law was created to...
I have no evidence of that. That's,
okay,
you know, like
well,
I said, the average man has no idea what you're talking about. And it's this kind of information is the stuff that I used to pursue. I can tell you all about, you know, the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917, the Reconstruction Acts in 1867, 68, there was two of them in 67. I can tell you all about, you know, in 1933, they modified the Trading with the Enemy Act to include all Americans. I can tell you all that stuff. I studied it all.
Oh, yeah.
And what it comes down to...
Let him finish.
What it comes down to is that information is utterly useless to the common man who just wants to go about his life. You know, these people deserve to be left alone. They deserve to be let alone, to have their life without complexity. Why should they have to learn this whole book? I've spent years and years studying stuff, and I would never put somebody through that kind of information because there's just no reason for it. And one of the biggest things I had a problem with, when I first met Carl, we were in the car together about 3 hours, and I realized I had to forget everything I had learned. All this stuff I had to forget if I was going to follow what he's teaching, because what he's teaching is the real simple fundamentals of law. And that's why I don't discuss that stuff anymore.
Right. The only thing I was pointing at is that the true nature and cause of the action required the person who is going to receive the money to come forward, which was the bankers who hold the note during the bankruptcy of 1933. But I don't follow that either. What I do is what you do. I pretty much tell the judge that I'm a flesh and blood man on the land, and they can't deal with that. I'm not the straw person. Full all capital letters, straw person corporation, because if you look up the definition of person,
none
that
of
guy
that,
in New York,
yeah,
is
none of,
person,
that's, none of that's relevant, Jim. Okay, you're a man. You're a
person,
man.
Wait a minute. Let me finish this thought. Defined in the law, a person is a corporation or a fiduciary or another country that's land in New York. And when I wrote my
whose definition is that?
That was from the state of New York. That I looked up definitions for the state of New York.
Those are terms. Those are not definitions of words. Those are definitions of terms. You're using their definition to describe you. Why are you assuming taking on the responsibility of their definitions?
No,
You've got no business messing with their law. It's copyrighted. It's their law. It's their definitions. Okay, you have no business being in legalese whatsoever. You're not a flesh and blood man. You're just a man. If you're a man, you obviously have flesh and blood. And the highest capacity that you could possibly have on this planet is that of being created in the likeness of God. That's it. Anything you add to that diminishes your capacity.
Oh, I understand that. Those are just the questions I had for you. So go ahead, Terry.
Thank you, Jim. Gus, I've got a couple of things I want to get into. One, I want to get into how to prepare before appearing at court. But I think we ought to take a couple of calls and get a couple of questions here and see why we've got some hands raised and let these callers have a shot. Is that okay, Gus?
Absolutely.
Code 661. Is that Simon in California? Area code 661, you did have your hand up. I will go to the next caller. You may be muted on your end. I'm giving you a shot here. You've got a live mic, area code 661.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we do.
Hello. Ah, okay. Sorry about that. Hold on 1 second. Let me get off this other line. I've been waiting for you.
That sounds like Carl.
Okay.
It does sound
Carl. So how are we doing this evening, gentlemen?
Doing great,
well.
Carl.
How are you doing?
Very good, very good. Unfortunately, I've been dealing with computer issues for some of my good friends, and they haven't really allowed me to take the time I need to listen to catch up with everything that you're doing, Gus. And I guess what I'm going to have to do is listen to the archive of the show. So that's going to be next on the agenda. But there's there's something that I don't know if you guys have explored or not, and that is how to invoke the common law court independently. Have you been looking at that?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
All right. A process by which you go to the clerk of court and you hand over a simple statement or a piece of paper that indicates that you are going to need the courtroom for a common law court of some sort. And that's basically what I'm talking about. Is that anything that you guys have looked at or looked into?
Well, when you file a claim, in the heading of your claim, it says, if you wish it to, it will say, I, a man, require court of record in quotes and trial by jury. Now, a court of record only operates according to the course of common law. So you don't have to say you're evoking common law, trying to go from evoking is to go from one jurisdiction to another.
Okay, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And I think was it on your site, Gus, that I saw some examples of how they invoked this? Or how they call forth this?
There's different. I've tried to give examples, especially of the word "you" and how that's used to manipulate people, how to get people back into their jurisdiction. So when you evoke common law, you're basically derailing the train, and the attorneys seek to put the train back on the tracks and keep on going. So I did give a few examples of that. I don't recall what they were, but
I'm not going to ask you to do that now. I'll get on one of those other calls with you, and we'll talk about this.
Okay.
Because have we had anybody do that recently, successfully?
People are doing it all the time.
That's something that those of us who are keenly interested in that aspect would love to talk to somebody like that, because we know that the traps will be laid as soon as you get there, and you have to know exactly how to avoid them. The concepts are simple, I know.
Okay. But if you have a lot of the clerks that are in these buildings, that are in these public courthouses, they are there at the good pleasure of the chief judge. And for the most part, you know, that's why they're there. They go according to whatever the chief judge decides on any particular thing. So when the chief judge changes, they may change how they do their paperwork, what they are willing to deal with. Typically, it comes down to one thing. If you come across as a man who knows what he's doing, who knows how to hold accountable his public servants, they will roll out the red carpet and let you go. And if they don't, they will quickly realize that they should have. On the other hand, if you're taking a stab at it and you're not sure what you're doing, they'll test you out, absolutely. You know, they're not willing to give up their courthouse and their bread and butter to just any old Joe that comes in with a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that. Okay. Well, that's...
Let me give you an example. There's, in England, Carl had visited. He'd helped these men with some pretty serious charges that they were facing, and successfully nullified everything. They walked away. Everything was good. And other people started learning this process, and they attempted to do the same thing. And I think there was 100 or so cases that were rejected by the court, flat out told, you know, sorry, we're not taking your case. And every one of these guys went home with their tail between the legs because they didn't know what to do next. They didn't know, they have no idea how to hold the clerk accountable. So, and the clerk knows it. You know, you get some guy who strays in, you know, he's got the lingo down, but he doesn't have it in his heart. He doesn't have it where it counts. You know, he's got the magic words, and he sounds like he knows what he's talking about. For instance, you know, I just saw somebody copied my website last night, and they're offering membership services, and you know, you can call us and for a fee, we'll help you out. And you know, anybody who goes there, if you have to copy my website, which is not that complex, if you have to copy my stuff to promote your stuff, to promote yourself, then chances are whoever you're helping out is just going to get a faster ticket to jail. You know?
Yeah, no lie.
It's not a good idea.
No, there's a whole bunch more involved here, but the concepts that I'm picking up from listening to Carl Lentz are simple, but they do demand that you be the man, period. Just be the man.
This is it's a way of life, and it's based on accountability. If you're a man, then you are accountable for your actions. If you have done no wrong, then you have the right to stand with your chest forward and demand that somebody come forward and accuse you. And that's it. So you live it, you breathe it, you walk it. The best way to learn this stuff is to teach other people. And that's exactly what the website's set up for. You know, on Wednesday nights, I do my call. Carl does his on Saturdays. Mike does his on Tuesday nights. Sonia does hers on Friday nights. So, you know, these people are all, you know, we all talk together. We all work together. We share each other's paperwork. And we run things by each other for corrections. So we're building this community of people that are able to reach out. You know, I mean, some of these people are, you're in Georgia. Mark is right there, 30 miles from where you're at. We talked about that last week. And, you know, Mike is in Toronto. Terry is in Colorado. You know, Catherine and Joe are up in British Columbia. Al is up there also. You know, Jonathan and Jesse are in New Brunswick. Bali is the man that's in England. So, you know, this is, the community is growing, and we're all working together. And it's just a matter of time before we start seeing a rapid increase in results.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Let's come back to that. Let's come back to that in just a few minutes, Carl. I'm going to leave your mic open, but I'm going to go to another caller and try to get in one more question before we kind of shift gears back to some on-topic stuff here.
Sure.
Thanks, Carl. But again, I'm leaving you open, so if you got background noise, just mute yourself.
Okay.
817, I believe that's our friend Becky in Texas, is it not? Are you there, Becky?
Hey, how are you doing?
We're doing really good. Do you have a question for Gus tonight?
Gus, I've tied in a young lady who works with a group called Vocal, specifically with the issues of child trafficking and CPS issues. She has a couple of questions. Her name is Mary Tyndall. Could you guys say hi to Mary? She's working real hard for justice for children.
Hey, Mary. Glad you're with us tonight.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I just learned of your show tonight. I've been listening, and I tell you what, I'm learning a lot. I'm just wondering, I've been hearing a lot about the differences from the common law to the real law or the English law. Now, I have a degree in criminal justice, so I'm a little bit familiar with all this, and I've been working with families for 10 years. I'm the national director for Vocal. I help families all over the country. I've been getting a lot of questions about the common law and what you do in court and how it affects things. Because things are just so bad, it's like they're erasing families. It's just beyond understanding. And I'm just wondering, what are the differences between the English law and the common law and the family courts?
When it comes to family law, the term, father, mother, child, parent, these are all statutory terms, and this is how they control what's going on. If you admit that you are a mother, a father, a parent, that you have children, then you are admitting that you are under the control of the government, that you're a person. However, when you go into court as a man or a woman and you make a claim for your property, also property is the highest form of ownership. It's exclusive to your use. And John Locke John Locke wrote a book called Two Treatises of Government. And in that book, he's got a couple of chapters on, I recommend you read the whole book, but he's got two chapters on property. And one of them is entirely about property. And in that book, I don't know if it's only, I read the whole thing, so I'm not sure which chapter it was in, but I remember him talking about a man's issue, that which issues from a man. And he was talking about children. And I thought, wow, what a great way to express your issue. You know, it's not children.
Yeah.
It's not statutory. So everything that you're doing has to do with the court. And if you're going into when they take your children, for instance, you know, they'll go in, they'll take somebody's children, and they'll give you an opportunity. They'll afford you the opportunity to come in and speak your piece. But everything you're doing is as a defendant, a pinata, somebody who's going to get the crap kicked out of them. That's your job.
Yeah.
Your job is to stand there and take it like a man. Well,
that's what
happens. That's exactly what happens. On the other hand, if you file a claim in your court, if you create your court, bring your claim forward, and require is a very important word. If you look it up in Webster's 1828, it is to demand as of right and by authority. So when you require the immediate restoration of your property, and that is your entire claim, nothing else, that's your claim, and you know what you're talking about, the government has to act. Because you're the one moving the court, and the other side is the defendant. It's their turn to be the pinata.
Interesting. Yeah, because
you,
a lot
if
of
you,
these parents...
If you,
Sorry?
If you call your children children, you get sucked right back in. That's what they'll do. They've done this with other people where they've gone in and required the restoration of their property. Speaking of their kids, they said, I require the restoration of my property. They've tried to get them to change it and not call them property. They tried to get them to change it to children. And the people have actually, in some cases, succumbed to that and had to go back in and say, wait a second, no, they're not children, they're my property. And then they release them to them. But they will try to suck people back into that game. It's a trick that they pull where they'll even agree to say, well, we'll work with you on this, but we want to call them children. You can't let them get away with that. You've got to stand your ground and stick to the term property. Correct, Gus?
Absolutely. And the problem is when you allow your issue to be called children, what you're doing is you're confessing that the state has the right to control your property.
No, it's the word. It's the word that causes them to be legal property.
I have a question. Well, can I explain something here? In the law, everything that you think the word means, it means something different. Like, I'll give you a real quick for instance. In the term employee for the IRS code, employee means, under Section 3401C of the IRS code, a state or federal elected official, federal employee, or corporate officer. So when you say that I am an employee, you're claiming to be one of those and are ignorant of the true meaning of those words, and that's how legalese works. So the state requires you to think that you're a resident, a voter, a person, a child. These are all words that they change the meaning of to fit their jurisdiction, and you come under that jurisdiction. That's how they play the game.
Gus, your comment to that?
That's exactly how it works. You know, it's all about the words, and the words are critical. If you are in their court, you cannot afford to speak because the words that come out of your mouth will, in midair, before they enter the ear canal of the judge, will be transformed into what he is hearing, which is legalese. You're speaking common parlance, common English, and somewhere between your mouth and his ears, it gets transformed into legalese. So when you're in their court, you cannot afford to speak. Everything has to be in writing. When you're in your court, then everything has to be by voice because everything has to be verified. So it's fatal to speak in their court. And in your court, it's fatal to remain silent. If you move a claim against someone and they remain silent, they will be found guilty. All right, because you're presumed innocent, but here's somebody saying you're guilty, and if you don't speak up, you've got a chance to face your accuser. You better say something. But it does come down to the words.
Those words.
Mary,
that's very interesting.
Did you have another question specific about that? Because I'll tell you what you're talking about here, as far as the way that the government has attacked so many people. I mean, they've used Child Protective Services to intimidate people. They have.
Oh, yeah.
They'll go after patriots. They'll go after people who are speaking out. Look at Schaefer Cox, for example, who is now in prison. They started out trying to attack him through his family, and sick Child Protective Services on him. Now, he managed to avoid that, but then so they railroaded him on federal firearm charges that were fraudulent and with false witness against him. But this is going on, and Carl Lentz particularly, I'll tell you, Gus knows this well. Carl is more interested in helping people get their kids back than just about any other topic. If you want to get his attention quick, he will not help somebody with common law go after another person if they know that they're going to damage them or use the common law to hurt other people, which you can do. If you know this stuff, and you use it, you can use it as a weapon. And Carl doesn't like it being used that way. But when it comes to restoring a family, when it comes to helping people get their kids back, that's a heartfelt situation, and that's the number one thing that the common law has been used for thus far. So it's very critical, very important for you in what you're doing and the people that you're working with and this organization that you're trying to lead. It is more important for you and your organization to understand this and to be able to bring people to this understanding and use than just about any other topic we can talk about.
Well, if there's any way you can send me some information or to Becky so that I can help my families. I work with people all over the nation, and it's just so bad because I can't even begin to tell you. I'm sure you know if you've been researching this. It's so bad.
The best place to get that information, and regardless of the topic, okay, this specific topic that you're talking about, I know for a fact that in the archives, Talk Shoe is online. If you put up one word, Talk Shoe, it'll take you to their website. And Carl's ID number, his call ID number, is 127469. And if you go through the archives to a recording back in April, you'll hear Jesse talking about, in about 20 minutes into the recording, you'll hear Jesse talking about what it was like to go to court. And that's recording 109. So number 109, episode 109. And listening to Carl's calls, listening to those episodes right from the beginning, I've got them on my website also. They link directly to Carl's Talk Shoe. Listening to this information is where you're going to get all that knowledge.
Yeah, and then the other thing that we're running across here is I don't know if anybody out there has ever heard of the Franklin cover-up. Well, we just now in Nebraska this last week, and I know no one's heard it on the news. I haven't seen it. Former cybersecurity head of Health and Human Services convicted of child porn enterprise. It's Nebraska. You see, nobody went to prison for that whole thing, and pedophiles don't stop being pedophiles. So these people have kept the network open. I have a case in Virginia now with Monica Wesolowski. Her child was sex trafficked into a foster home with two gay men who raped him. There are pictures. There's so much evidence, and the detective will not hand it over to the prosecutor. It's a big, fat mess. This child continues to be abused. It is so bad, I can't even begin to tell you how bad it is out there. I don't know if you know or not, or if you've heard. The families need help.
Heard,
they need help so bad.
I have heard about it, but there's nobody that has the right to fix somebody else's problem. In our system of law, the government is created to secure and protect a man's property. However, I cannot act on your behalf and try to save the world. Whoever has been harmed, whoever's property has been taken, that is the man or the woman that has to come forward. They have to move their court. They have to make claim to their property. So this is dependent on every man or woman to learn the lessons themselves, learn how to do these things, and to create communities. Obviously, there's people that are concerned about this, and there's people that are concerned about fluoride, and there's people that are concerned about Common Core. These are all issues that in New Hampshire I wrote petitions for the redress of grievances, and you find these groups of people that are like-minded to what your cause is, and you start working together, learning together, and in very little time, you're going to have a really good working knowledge of what to do next.
Amen. Well, and every one of the things that you just mentioned are the reasons they're taking the children away.
Well, Mary, I don't want to tie up this conversation. I want to keep it on the common law with Gus, but if you could give me a call later, we're hooked to John DeCamp. Okay, in Unite for Justice. John DeCamp is part of our group, and he wrote the book, The Franklin Cover-Up, and there's a lot more going on. that I can talk to you personally about. So if you want my number, I can give it to you. Is that okay, Terry, for me to give her my number?
If you want everybody in the world to hear it, otherwise I can simply pass it on to Becky and Becky can give it to Mary.
Thank you for your time. I'm sorry if I didn't mean to interrupt or take over your show, and I appreciate
no,
any help
you. Mary, you have not. This is important. And I'll pass Doug Millar's number, who is Jim's co-host at Angel Fear to Tread there on Crusade Radio. Doug Millar has worked very closely. We've actually had John DeCamp on here at Walls in Our Minds a couple of times in the past along with Doug. And Doug's very close to him, and I'll simply pass that information on to Becky, and she'll get it to Mary. Right? Is that okay, Mary?
Yeah, yes, sir. Thank you so much for your time, and I really am enjoying your show, and I'll just listen now. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good night. Have a blessed evening.
Too.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Gus, let's come back. We've got about 8 minutes left. Doug, was that you trying to say something?
Yeah, I said thank you. I'm glad that Jim brought that up because I was going to do the same thing.
Having trouble understanding you. We'll take care of it off air. Gus, let's come back to this. We got about 8 minutes left. I'd like to talk about preparing. In other words, what is needed prior to going to court? You know, you've talked a little bit about drawing out a man, the importance of writing some letters if somebody's trying to force you into court on a defendant position. Can you talk a little bit about what it takes to prepare and why that's important?
John Camp, who wrote the Franklin cover, is going to call me.
Before you make a claim against some poor man working for the government, you know, who thinks he's just doing his job, you have to make sure that you're dealing with the right man or the right woman. So letter writing is very important. I should have brought it up long before now. Writing a letter to whoever it is that you believe is causing you harm is very important. And you write that letter very basic. You know, are you the man or the woman that I need to talk to about this particular issue? And that's it, one simple question. You send it to the man or the woman, whoever you're dealing with, and they will answer you, no, you should be talking to Bob about this, I just handle accounting. Great, so now you have the new contact, you send the same letter to the other guy. Bob, are you the man that I need to be dealing with regarding this issue? Bob says, yes, I'm the man, I can help you out. And now you start the communications process of dealing with that man. And what the purpose of this is really important. A lot of people miss this. What you're doing is you're communicating with a man. So you're going to ask very reasonable questions, and the man or the woman is going to give you logical answers, logical responses to your questions. And the simpler your questions are, the easier it will be for the man or woman on the other end to answer you. And at some point, you're going to establish who you are, what's going on, the facts concerning the issue. You're going to verify that they do have the authority to cause the harm to cease and desist. And you will send them fair warning. You let them know, look, I know the government exists as a benefit to man, not to destroy a man's life, you know, not to cause harm. And the actions of your agency, of the agency you work for, which you have the authority to control, are causing me harm. And, you know, I wish for you to stop doing what you're doing and stop this harm from happening to me, and you let it be and see what you get back for an answer. But at some point, if you say, if you don't do this, I'm going to sue you, that's a threat. You're communicating a threat. It's extortion. You can't do that stuff. So your letter writing has to be gentle, and when you're communicating with a man or a woman, what you're essentially doing is you're drawing them away from their immunity as a government employee. Because when you establish that you're dealing with a man or a woman, then you know, who has the capacity to fix a problem, to correct something that's causing you harm, and they don't do that, now they do become liable in their private capacity to, you know, for the harm that's being done to you. So, you know, the letter writing is extremely crucial, but the intent is to try to get the thing resolved without having to go to court.
Carl, your buddy, I mean, Gus, your buddy Carl has got a live mic. You want to introduce him?
Yeah, Carl. Carl's a great guy. He's got more common sense than anybody I've ever met. And I followed some gurus a few years ago. I went and met these people, and when I met them, I realized, oh man, I don't know what I'm doing following these guys and learning from these guys. And one of the reasons I wanted to meet Carl was for that specific reason, is I wanted to check him out and make sure he was real, because I didn't want to waste any more of my life. So Carl teaches common sense, and we call it Lent sense, and he's just a great guy. A lot of people know stuff. You know, they have information, but to put it into practical use, practical applicability for everyday use, I've never met anybody who's got the capacity to do that as well as Carl. Carl, say hi.
Hey. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
We hear you fine.
Yeah, like I was telling Gus, I said basically it was on the American folklore that was written down around the Civil War time, and it was basically an accumulation of all the folklore. That was, they call it Tales of Uncle Remus. Is that what they call it, Gus? The Stories of by Uncle Remus?
Yeah, it was, it's told by Uncle Remus, and the actual title is, let's see. I just got the book in last week. I don't have it. Hold on. Yeah, it's Uncle Remus. It's written by Joel Chandler Harris.
Yeah, what I basically do is when I tell stories, I basically just try to make it in simple terms, depending on who I talk to. Gus lived here, I think, for 4 weeks, 9, 11 weeks. I'm not sure how many weeks he lived here, but he lived here for quite a while. And he said to somebody one day, I would ask Carl a question, like on Monday, and by Wednesday or Thursday, he'd give me an answer. Because I was trying to figure out a way that what Gus has been involved with in his life, you know, hanging sheetrock, drywall, and having children and his age group, to try to come up with an answer that he's comfortable with. So you can't just make one-size-fits-all answers when it comes to this stuff. But like I said, what Gus was saying a little while ago about when you talk to a government agent, the very first question you basically have to send to them is one sentence saying, I believe that you are the man or woman who has been signed my case. Is this true? And that's it. You don't say anything else, because anything else will scare them off. And as soon as you say, you put it in the capacity, are you the man or the woman who's been assigned my case, this case? Have you been assigned this case? They say yes. And they say, you know, they say, my name is Carl. You know, what is your name? It's very simple. You're drawing them out of their official capacity, because you ask them if they're the man or the woman who's been assigned this case. If they say, no, I am the agent who's been assigned this case, you could tell that they're not willing to fall into the trap, that they're not going to bear full liability of their actions. They're going to hide under color of law. They're not going to come out as man-to-man. They're going to hide in person. In person just simply means in Greek to be wearing a mask. So they won't pull down the mask. So you could pull them out of a lineup, pick them out of a lineup and say, you have done me harm, injury, you've done wrong. They're not going to allow it. But 99% of the time, these agents have no clue when you ask them a very simple question, because it's so simple, the questions I ask them. Just, are you the man, I believe that you're the man or woman who has been assigned this case. Is this not true? Or is this true? And usually they'll say, yes, I've been assigned this case. My name is Susie.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but we are completely out of time. Gentlemen, we could go on for a long time, but our show ends in 5 seconds. So I'm going to have to say goodnight to everyone. Carl, thanks for calling in. I'd love to have you back on, and you and Gus are welcome to do a show here anytime you want.
Hey, Gus did good. Gus did good, man. I was listening to him. He did fine.
He did awesome. Gus, thank you so much. Carl Swenson, thanks for calling in tonight. Becky, good to hear from you always. And Red Beckman, you had an open mic, but there's just been too much going on to try to get you in here. I'll have to say goodnight to everybody. We'll see you next Thursday night on Walls in Our Minds.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is on the earth. Is that all that Peter told? After the story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your rights. Come on.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you will look for yours unhurt. And now you see the light, you stand up for your right. Yeah,
get up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up.
Get up, stand up.
Don't give up the fight.
Life is your right.
Get up, stand up.
We can't give up the fight.
Stand up for your right.
Lord, Lord.
Get up, stand up.
Keep us bubbling on.
Don't give up the fight.
Yeah.
We're sick and tired of your easy kissing game. Dine and go to heaven in a Jesus name, Lord. We know and we understand, Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light.
What you
gonna, we gonna stand up for
a
right.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
You better
get up, stand up
in the morning.
Give it up,
stand up for your right.
Stand up right now.
Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Stand up
for your right.